I submitted this subject, and I don't know whether I'll shift gears or just keep on with it, because I thought it might be a frame on which I could hang a number of things that I just won't talk about. And then, too, I realize that there aren't many grandparents here. Dorothy is here, and she's a great-grandparent, which is a bit of upmanship on me. But, and Nora, and I suppose that's about the census. Anyway, I'm not apologetic to pose as a grandfather, and in the context of people who aren't grandfathers or grandmothers, it struck me about 5 years ago when a student was visiting me with me in the office, and he said, "You know the gap between me and you, that is, and George Oss and some others who were of my age on the faculty," he said, "the gap between me and you is not as great as between me and Charlie Anderson and Jim Burtness and Wendell Ferrix and that crowd that had high school kids about that time." And that struck me as kind of funny for the moment. I thought that the older you got, the bigger the gap. Then I thought back on my own childhood or my own youth. And then I realized that the gap between me and my grandfather at one time was not as great as the gap between me and my father. And so I took courage and figured I could even talk to high school groups again, which I used to do when I was younger. And that maybe the gap had tended to close rather than widen. So that maybe the observations I make are not observations that pertain only to grandparents, but to people of other ages. I want to go back to tonight to draw from my grandfather and my father the observations that have surfaced across the years. My grandfather, well, I must say, I was the oldest grandchild, and none of my grandparents died until I was 22. And my father had a general store in town, and one grandfather lived 2 miles from town, and the other lived 3 miles from town. And I was on their farms a good deal. And particularly my father's father, whose name was Andrew, I developed quite a life with him. And he came over from Norway in 1867, and homesteaded out in South Dakota. And I never tired of listening to him tell about those early days with the blizzards and the prairie fires and the grasshoppers and the drought and all of those things that jeopardized his life. His first home was a sod hut on the hillside, and there weren't many hills in South Dakota. And his second home was a log cabin, which later on I was able to see. They used it as a garage, so that I could project myself back a bit into those days. Now, he emigrated from Norway because things were just too rough there. He wasn't of the aristocracy, while his father was a landholder, my grandfather was not the oldest son, so he couldn't inherit the farm. And there was nothing for him to do but to do something other than be a landholder, unless he could marry somebody who had one daughter and who was a landholder. Then he could get into the possession of land again. So he, among thousands at that time, emigrated to the United States. So there was no heroism about this. He didn't leave because he was persecuted religiously, nor because he had such an adventuresome spirit, or was such an entrepreneur, or anything like that. It was just a grim business of existing and of having some hope in the future of a better state than before. So there's no way to make heroes of these people necessarily. though, unless you can build legends around them. And I often thought, after reading Rolvog's Giants in the Earth, how many of you have read that? Number of you have. What it must have been like for him. I hadn't thought of it so much until in 1952, when I went to Norway for the first time and saw where he came from, these beautiful mountains and fjords. It's like moving out of Holden to the Red River Valley. And I remember Barrett, some of you do who read the book, who lost her bearings for a time out there on the prairies and crawled into a big chest, and her husband opened the chest and found her huddling there, frightened as a frightened animal. And she said, out here there's nothing to hide behind, and that there's nothing to lean against. And you could just imagine what it must have been like for them to get used to this prairie country in the Dakotas. he was, as I remember him, of course, I remember him only as a retired man, because my uncle had taken over the farm, and so I remember my grandfather smoking his pipe under the elm tree or on the porch, or walking up to the mailbox, usually a half an hour before the mail was scheduled to come, and then he'd seat himself with his pipe and wait for the mailman. And he was generally a quiet man with a goatee. About 10 years ago, more than 10 years ago, I suppose, when beards were a threat to our society. I had a letter one day from a lady who said, last Sunday, we had a young pastor preach to us. He had long hair and a beard. He looked just like Judas, she said. I wrote her back. I thought I should have said, how come he didn't remind you of somebody else like Jesus? But I didn't want to do that. But I said, I have two grandfathers, both had beards, and they were gentle people, so that I don't get much alarmed over these beards. I never remember him talking much about religion, but he was a devout man. And if there weren't church on Sunday, he'd gather us all together around in the living room, and then he'd open a book of sermons that he had from Norway and read an interminably long sermon, as I remember, in Norwegian, which wasn't my first language. But I have those memories of him as a calm, collected person. And I think one time in the late 20s, when the lakes were going dry out in South Dakota, and there were rumors that probably we'd be a desert, then I still remember my grandfather saying, I've seen these lakes dry before. You know, it was just as if, well, you know, this will pass too. And I guess that's helped me a lot of times in thinking of today as a crisis day. Every age is a crisis of some kind, and you wonder if the end isn't going to come, if the whole thing isn't going to collapse. And while I realize that it could collapse and you'd have catastrophe, this refrain from my grandfather comes back, and I've seen these lakes dry before. Just don't get too excited about this. Now, just because they've been dry before and gotten moisture again, of course, doesn't mean that it's going to happen that all the time, I suppose. It's poor logic, I realize. It's like the old woman who at 90 said she was glad that it was the month of May again. And somebody said, why are you glad that it's the month of May? And she said, I've lived 90 months of May, and I've never died in the month of May. So the logic isn't exactly good, but it's kind of a reassurance for my grandfather, because he was not an excitable person, and he had, at that age, a rather long perspective. He wasn't given to chattering much. He could sit with his pipe, and you could sit by him, and he wouldn't have to carry on a conversation. And a quarter of a mile away, his brother, who had immigrated at the same time, had a farm, and both now were retired, and my grandfather would go down to visit him. My grandfather could walk more easily than his brother. So they'd sit there on the porch. I'd walk with him sometimes and hang around and wait for him to come back, or so we could come back home. And they'd sit for 2 hours and probably not say a single word. They'd just look out across the pond. There was a kind of slough out there and toward the east. And I suppose their minds wandered farther east than that, across the ocean, back to home. And then he'd come home and tell grandmother what a nice visit he'd had with Peter. And I was puzzled. How come he had a nice visit when they never talked at all? And since that time, I've gotten to think that that's probably the height of communication, where two spirits are so in tune that you don't have to hunt up a subject, but that you are, in a sense, communicating with each other without words. Then I saw him, of course, as an indulgent person. He was a pal of mine. He let me smoke his pipe if I wouldn't tell my father. And he didn't have to scold me, of course. That was my father's business, to whip me into shape, so he could just take me as I was. And I never remember him really giving orders to me. And I think that's the role of the grandfather, not to give orders. And when I was taking care of four of my grandchildren, while their mother and father went to a wedding, and everybody was gone, I said, "I'll take care of them until you come back." Well, it was a 12-hour stint. And my granddaughter, who was then four, when it was time to go to bed, she wasn't going to go to bed. And so I became stern and ordered her to bed. And she just looked at me, puzzled, bewildered, that I would give orders at all. My role had suddenly shifted from being indulgent and just plain enjoying her and to ordering her. One of my twin grandsons at the lake last summer, he asked for a bun at breakfast time, and when he bit into the bun, he made some awful sign, "Oh, I don't like this." And I said, "John, you eat it." He looked at me startled, and he quick took a bite, and he said, "Boy, this tastes wonderful." He shifted gears fast too when I shifted gears. Well, I never remember my grandfather doing that, and that's not the role of the grandparent after all. Unfortunately, we don't have to do it much. And I got his Huspostil, that book of sermons, in Norwegian. In the first parish I had to preach Norwegian once a month, the first time I wrote out a sermon, and the second time I wrote out a sermon and translated it into Norwegian in a rather bumbling way, and I got along all right. But the third time around, the third month, it was a laborious thing, so I thought, well, I'll just copy a sermon from this book of my grandfather's, which I did, and got up into the pulpit and read it. And then the fourth Sunday around, I was about to copy one again, and I thought, why should I sit at the typewriter and copy this? So I took a razor blade and just cut out the pages and took them into the pulpit and read from those. And the fifth time around, about the time I was cutting out some more pages, I thought to myself, I'm not going to ruin this book. So I just took the big book up in the pulpit and read from it. Well, my career as a Norwegian preacher lasted about 9 months. Last service, there were six people there, including the organist. And so I never announced it anymore. But the Huspo still came in handy for a little while. Well, with this increased interest in roots, how many of you indulge or do something with genealogies in your family? Anybody? Do you? How far back can you go?
About 1610.
16th century? Oh, very good.
17th
century. Very good. How about you?
Great-great-grandparents.
Pardon?
Great-great-grandparents.
Well, that's pretty good. I think you ought to. I think you ought to. Try every which way. Now, I don't know what you'll find when you get back somewhere. You probably find something you don't want to find. Some horse thief is back there who spent time in jail. But I think for the most part, it's important, I think it's very important in our day for a person to, it's a part of creating identity or having identity. It isn't the only thing, certainly, but it's valuable. And I think it'd be an excellent thing for... How did you get back to the 16th century, Tom?
The 17th century. 17th. My father wrote to relatives in Sweden and had them look it up.
Oh, yeah. Have you been in Sweden? Any of you been back in Europe where your family's originated? Mm-hmm. It's a great thing to do. I don't know what it does for you, but I'm sure it does something good to be anchored back there. I can't go back beyond my great-grandfather, who died at the age of 95. My grandfather died at the age of 84. My father died at the age of 66. I should have been dead long ago. Well, let me go on to my father. And I'll hang in with him, I think, at a moment. Because his life poses an observation for me. He had a general store that he started in this little village when it began out in South Dakota. And he had this general store for 45 years until he died. There was a sense in which he walked the same two blocks, turned the same key for 45 years. Not quite, because his store burned down one time, so of course he relocated, but relocated on the same street and had the same customers, essentially. the same wife. For 32 of those years, the same preacher. And you'd have to ask yourself, in this repetitious life, wasn't there unending boredom? And I don't know whether I ever thought of him as bored. But it was, on the surface, an uneventful life. But after he was gone, after he died, then people began to tell me about him. And a young man who had another store in town, in competition with my father, said nobody knew that it was your father who loaned me money to set up a store to compete with him. And I was registering in a hotel one night when a fellow observed my name and said, "Are you Bert Rodness? Are you related to Bert Rodness?" And I said, "Yes, he's my father." Well, he said, "Let me tell you, I've been on the road traveling, salesman, for many years, and during the war years when commodities were short, the company told me not to visit those small towns, but just visit the bigger towns. But," he said, "I always made your father, because he was the finest man on my whole route." And I remember my father telling about the Depression, when the money was so tight that his customers couldn't pay him. And he said, I just forgot all about them, about the bills they owed. Said, "I just marked off several thousand dollars because they couldn't pay me, and they were the men and women who had kept me in business all these years." And after the Depression was over, most of them came and paid him, even though for years they hadn't gotten a bill from him. There was that element of trust and confidence that the community had in him. He wasn't an exciting man. You know, he didn't have any hobbies. I never remember him with a fishing pole. I never remember him playing ball with us. I don't remember, he hardly ever read a book. He was very busy from morning till night with his business and had a lively interest in people. He was a good businessman in a small way. I'm sure had he been working for Dayton's, he would have been a vice president. He was a good businessman. Even when all these small businesses were folding, he had his constant credit rating with Dun & Bradstreet. He was proud of that, even though it was a small operation. He was a devout man like my grandfather, but never talked religion much. He marshaled us all to church, of course, all six kids, and he broke tradition by having them all sit on his side, mother and the six children and he, when at that time all the men sat on this side and the women sat on that side. Either that was because he didn't have confidence that mother could keep us in tow. I rather think it was that he was proud of his family and he wanted to be sure God saw them. The teacher was always right. No teacher would have any trouble with him about his children misbehaving. I remember I got into a scrape one time with several others, and we were given a public flogging in the two-room schoolhouse that we had. Both rooms were gathered in one place, and we were the victims, the villains, and were flogged. And I remember my chief concern being to get back home and tell my father that I'd been whipped by the teacher before my younger twin brothers got to him and squealed on me so that I'd get a second beating. I figured that by getting to him first, I'd avoid a second one, which I did. But you could be sure that the teacher was always right. His first loyalty, I like to think, was to God. And then in the order was his family, his church, his customers, his village and country, and the Republican Party. And there's a line in Longfellow's poem, The Psalm of Life, "Great men all remind us we can make our lives sublime, and departing leave behind us footprints on the sands of time." Footprints that perhaps another, sailing o'er life's solemn main, a forlorn and shipwrecked brother, seeing, will take heart again. Now I ask myself, what did the poet mean? He probably meant the great writers and the great generals and the great leaders of countries. And while I enjoy biography, I don't think that I am inspired by the greatness of these so-called great people, the illustrious people. I think most of my inspiration has come from the greatness that I've found in common people. I read, before I get off on that, let me go back to boredom. This was a pretty simple life, you know, and we didn't have an abundance of things. And I've asked myself, what is the solution to boredom? Is it to have enough money to buy everything you want and travel anywhere you like? I think one of the tragic things is that that's sometimes the solution that an affluent society has for boredom. And I remember a good friend of mine who is rich and had his business affairs in such a way that he didn't have to handle his business. who had traveled from one place to another, and at just before Christmas we were visiting, and I said, "Where are you going to spend Christmas?" And he said, "Well, I guess we won't be spending it with our two children because they were scattered somewhere. So I suppose we'll go to Los Angeles, and if we get tired of that, we'll go to Hawaii." And then he looked at me and he said, "Al, those swimming pools get old awfully fast. You know, how do you cope with boredom?" And I think when I see sometimes at Christmas time our grandchildren getting so many presents, they are just completely distracted from one to another, that probably we had a better time with one present or two, handmade maybe, a whistle that somebody had made from a willow twig, than my grandchildren have from this abundance. I don't quite know how to handle that, but I'm sure that boredom is not conquered by the tools of affluence that our society may give us. Now I want to come back to that, but let me say something about greatness. I read this past year a biography of the Rockefellers, written by two authors, and I can't even remember the names. Any of you have seen the volume? Well, anyway, it starts with J.D. Rockefeller, who started as a bookkeeper and a devout Baptist young man who, earning $3.20 a week, gave 32 cents to the missions of his church every week. He was a tither. And then, of course, he became immensely rich. And the second generation built on the fortunes of the first, of J.D. the first, and third generation, which we know best, Nelson Rockefeller and Winthrop and David and the others, kept building again on this vast fortune. The fourth generation is repudiating this, not repudiating, but they don't want to be the tycoons and the moguls. And the third generation is having a hard time getting these 25 cousins now to settle in to the business enterprises that they have. And I was, and the author says that they are in effect discovering that this vast fortune is a burden, and they somehow want to get out from under it. And he told about one of the daughters of David Rockefeller, who is the head of Chase National Bank, and the enterprises of Chase National, I never realized, they have 1,700 vice presidents across the world. Anyway, this daughter of David's was married to a student who was doing his PhD at Berkeley, and she was, she had a vegetable garden and would bring her vegetables into the store to sell. And the author said, wouldn't the grocer be surprised to discover that it was the daughter of the head of Chase National that was bringing in these groceries? But they were trying to live on $600 or $700 a month that they were putting together themselves. And this daughter asked her father, "Father, how much money do I have?" And David, her father said, "When you're 21, you will have a trust fund of $25 million. But that's not all, of course, that you have." And she said, "I don't want it." And he said, "You have no option. You can't give it away. You can give away the income or use the income of it until you're 35, because old J.D. had set it up in such a way that she couldn't get rid of it until she was 35. I suppose he was counting on her coming to her senses by 35 and fitting into the pattern. In any event, it was just kind of tragic. The kids couldn't invite their friends home from college, because they were kind of ashamed of this vast estate with huge iron fences all around. So that these cousins were kind of driven to each other and couldn't get beyond. so that these cousins were kind of driven to each other and couldn't get beyond. And you may remember several years ago, David, another David Rockefeller, who married a Norwegian maid working for his mother, Nelson Rockefeller's son, and Nelson Rockefeller flew over to Norway for the wedding, as you may remember. And David finished Union Theological Seminary and then went on to get his degree at Columbia and teaches philosophy in a small college and lives on the same level as the other, as his colleagues. Almost tries to keep secret the fact that he's got all this money. It was just a tragic commentary on is the possession of power or the possession of wealth any criteria of greatness? And I'm sure that if they have fondness for each other, it's a fondness that breaks through these hurdles of power and money and finds those common qualities that make for greatness anywhere. I guess probably you'd have to say, when somebody says everybody's inspired by a winner, I'm not sure. I'm not at all sure about that. Does everybody love a winner? No. I think it's much easier to love a person who comes in second. And he's not a winner, and I'm not a winner. We can handle each other. But to be in the presence of a winner is not an inspiration, generally. It's a temptation to envy if something. And moreover, we will, who are coming second and third and fourth, are likely to maroon that winner. We don't want to be with him. There's a strong inclination that way. So I think the inspiration that one gets is more likely to come from ordinary people who under no circumstances, by the standards of the world, can be called great, but you see qualities of greatness in them, and you treasure those. I was about to write, well, I wrote a few things called on great people I've known, and one of them was a pastor. He never married, and in the Depression he was called to Canada to a parish of 17 preaching places in the plains of Alberta. And he had no car, and he would ski from one place to another in the winter, 40 degrees below zero. I hadn't seen him for years, and I was in Alberta some years ago. Now he was a chaplain in a hospital there, a shrunken little fellow, and I thought to myself, that fellow will have more stars in his crown than all the presidents of the churches put together, and of the seminaries too, by the way. It was a simplicity of faith and an affection for people and a devotion to them that knew hardly any limits. And in one of the parishes that we served, one of the families I got acquainted with fairly quickly was an old couple. They were then in their early 60s. They lived in the back of a warehouse. They'd never been able to accumulate money enough to have a home. And he was working, this was of course in the early 40s, before wages had gone up. He was working in a common as a janitor, I think, for $19 a week. And when I called on their little home, a little place, I noticed in the corner of the room, on a little shelf, a can. It looked like a pork and beans can that had its label torn off. And he wasn't there, but she noticed that I saw it, and she said, with a smile, she said, "That's our tithe can." And the first thing they did when he got his $19 was to put $1.90 in that little can for the Lord. And I still see them walking to church hand in hand, this little old couple. And it always shamed me to think that there was no self-pity. They were cheerful. And and no bitterness. And I thought, there's genuine greatness. So I think it's, when I think of my, going back to my father, that there was nothing really to signal him as having achieved a great deal. He left his business in good shape, but it was a modest business, and nothing very much to write home about. I think one of the things I learned from him was trust. How important it is to trust. He trusted his kids. They didn't deserve it. I didn't deserve it all the time. So he trusted me farther than he ought to have trusted me, probably. But I remember one time I was accused of having stolen something from another store, a hardware store. And that rumor reached my father. And he asked me if I had done it. Did you? And I said, no, I haven't. He didn't press it, took me by the hand, walked me down to the hardware store, and told his friend, the hardware dealer, he did not take it, and I want you to apologize to him. And that impressed me greatly, I suppose, 11 years old, that he wanted that man to apologize to me for mistrusting me. And I remember Nora's father, who was a pastor, saying it's far better to trust too far than not far enough. And you may seem naive at times, but this matter of trust is of great consequence. It's not always easy for parents to come off as trusting, because they are so concerned for the safety of their kids. And so they'll come off at times as if not, they don't trust them. When the only thing they're eager about is the safety of their kids. Those of you who have grandparents and parents, do you think the gap between you and your parents is greater than the gap between you and your grandparents? No?
Yeah. I get along with my grandparents a lot.
You get along better with your grandparents? Yeah, anybody else?
I'm closer to my parents.
Closer to them. Is that because your grandparents are farther away, do you think? Or are they nearby?
No, they are a long way away.
Yeah. I think that, of course, is a factor, real factor.
I'm closer to my parents now, but maybe 10 years ago I was closer to my grandparents.
Mm-hmm. Your parents have learned a few things.
My grandmother's body, but I was close to her, I think, at least last few years ago, but I asked my parents. There's a different, I mean, I'm close to both of them, but a different kind of closeness. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's difficult for me to ask my parents and I to pray mm-hmm. with any kind of prayer.
Mm-hmm.
But my grandmother, you didn't have a choice.
Oh, yeah.
And that kind of relationship, you know, just in that, and just talking about things, she was very wise.
Mm-hmm.
In things that my parents try to think they don't want to be wise in. It's just the vicissitudes of life.
Mm-hmm.
She did.
Mm-hmm. You think your parents trust you? Because most of you are far away from them. They have to trust you.
were alive, or at least my grandmothers were alive, they always seemed to know who I was. And I always seemed to know who they were. But my parents didn't always know. And my conception of them changed a great deal from year to year. And they had certain ideas of me that weren't met, whereas my grandmothers knew who I was, you know, knew who I was.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't change much really in my conception through the years either.
Mm-hmm.
I think that has some of it. There's more continuity.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow with my grandmothers and myself and there was between my parents.
Mm-hmm.
Continuity of conception.
Yeah. I suppose that... Well, as far as my grandfather and my father were concerned, my grandfather had more time for me than my father did. So that was a factor. And later on, when I saw my father in relation to my children, he now a grandfather, I saw the same qualities in him as I had seen in my own grandfather. So that changed too. And of course, every parent has certain ambitions for his children. I remember in all those years until we'd all grown up, I don't think my father ever traveled more than 200 miles away from home, and that was to the cities to buy, on buying trips. And he took me along one time when I was about 12. And we caught a train and at night, so we were in the Pullman. apparently the porter had remembered my father, and then he was nice to me, and he patted me on my head, and he said, "Are you going to be as good a man as your father?" Which was, I suppose you'd ask that of any child, and I still remember my father's quick reply, "He's going to be a much better man." I thought to myself that later on, that's what every parent wants and desires, that his child be more successful or better or whatever than he is. And sometimes that comes off as a pressure upon the child to perform in certain ways that are not palatable to the child or to the young person. And it's hard, I think, for a parent to remember that every child is, the moment he's born, he's a world of his own. And the great gift that God has given this child is self-determination, not to capitulate all the time to others, including parents. But this is a delicate arrangement that the Lord has imposed on us. He told the parents to bring up the children in the way they ought to go, and at the same time have given these children the great gift of self-determination and the gift of choice. And if that's crushed, something beautiful is crushed. You know, when I think of, I get envious for all of you, I think. The community in which I lived was this homogeneous community. They were all Norwegians and they were all Lutherans. There was only one church in town. And the Northwestern Railroad that had a little spur into town, the spur ended there, so we had a turntable. That was always interesting for the kids to help turn that big engine around. They sent in an Irish Catholic for a depot agent one time, which was, treachery. But he was a jovial character and learned a few Norwegian phrases. And and got along famously, because if he could talk a little Norwegian, everybody thought he was honest and all right. But we knew everybody, and it was, when I think of an extended family, this was it. I had 15 uncles and aunts living nearby, and it wasn't uncommon for, you know, at least half of them with their families to come on the farm on a Sunday afternoon. And since that time, I realized I grew up with the strength of the tribe. If anybody would attack me, they'd have to take on all my uncles and aunts. And my kids don't have that, and I'm sure you haven't had that. And it wasn't only the uncles and aunts, but the whole community. If you did well, they were pleased. They applauded you. If you didn't do very well, they groaned. And you had this pressure, this gentle pressure, let's say, to hold you up, or to guide you, or do whatever. And I think of, I suppose it's rare, it's not possible anymore that you have communities like that, where everybody stays put. See, my two uncles had the bank in town, and another uncle had another store, and then my aunts married farmers and others, and so we were all together. It wasn't until my generation came along that we had to leave. And then we began to scatter. And now I don't know how scattered your community, how scattered your people are, your brothers and sisters, and your mother and father, and your grandparents, and uncles and aunts, but I suppose you cover the continent, most of you, and probably overseas, if you were all to get together. That's an enviable thing, and I think I thought it's very important, both on the basis of your roots and in keeping in touch, either by letters, writing, or visits whenever you can, keeping in touch with those who are your family, not only the nuclear family, but your cousins and others. If you can, I realize that the extended family implies something other than blood. So that for many of you, I'm sure Holden has become an extended family, and a very significant one. And you've developed friends here that are probably more supportive than brothers or sisters, or certainly uncles or aunts. But it's still of extreme importance, I think, to cultivate as much of an extended family as is possible. I've done most of the talking. Is there any questions that anybody would like to ask me, or some observations that you'd like to make relating to any of this? As I've done tonight, about the past this much, and probably not in upon some of the experiences that I've had, that you too are having or have had, which I hope I can get into on Wednesday night when we get together. Because I don't want this just to be an oral autobiography.
I think my mother's been involved in the last year in translating old letters. And I've been reading some of these letters. And I'm struck by how alive those people have become. My grandmother was engaged to my grandfather when she was 16 years old. He was 26. And the letter she wrote to him, you know. And I knew her as an old lady, most of the time senile. Mm-hmm. And you never think of people as being like you are.
Mm-hmm.
You think, well, they were, you know, that was the grandma, she was such and such a wife. Then I read the love letter she wrote to her fiancé.
Mm-hmm.
She just, and not only that, but I've been thinking about that a lot lately, just in terms of the saints of the church, or, you know, even farther back than our grandparents or great-grandparents. Go back to one of the hymns I love is the one that ascribed to Theotistus of the Studium, Jesus' name, all names above. And that person said those words that are the same words that we might say.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The human race was those people that had the same feelings and minds, and just always leaves me sort of
Yeah, I think whether they, you know, whether they rode on donkeys or used oxen or flew in airplanes, essentially the same kind of people.
Seems like that's what it must mean, that we're made in the image of God.
Yeah.
There's some pulse, living pulse there in that.
Yeah. I think the continuity, of course, is you talk about the one holy Christian church and the people of the faith, more than we realize, that's a thread that ties us together. I've used an illustration at times that if I preach at a 100th anniversary of a congregation, and oftentimes this is a congregation out in the country with a graveyard all around. And I've said, supposing one of the great-grandmothers of this congregation who had died maybe 100 years ago or so were to ask the Lord if she could come back for a week and see how her great-grandchildren were getting along. And supposing you gave her that privilege and she came down or came over or whatever. And she'd be completely bewildered. You know, she'd notice that these people were pushing buttons and lights would come on and they'd turn knobs on a box and figures would begin to move on a piece of glass and voices would come and she'd notice these vehicles without benefit of oxen or horses, you know, roaring around and she'd look up and see those strange birds screeching overhead and you know, she'd think she was in another world, and these people, they dressed differently and they didn't seem like her people, and by the end of the week she was quite discouraged that these weren't her people after all. And then she'd come into church on Sunday and sit there with them, and then something would happen. She'd hear some of the same hymns that she had known as a child, and if it's a Lutheran service, it would be in almost the same sequence, the confession of sin and the declaration of forgiveness and the same Bible, and when the she'd notice that in the prayers her great-grandchildren were sitting rapt in prayer, and then the preacher would preach the same old story from the same old book, and suddenly her heart would be filled with joy that these were her children after all. The externals notwithstanding, they were of her family, which was in effect a profounder family than blood. And while that doesn't, we don't experience that as we ought to in the average congregation and in the average group, that we are a company that are held together in the faith, as well as people who in the 20th century will have their profoundest joys and their profoundest sorrows in the same basic experiences that they had a century, 2 centuries, 10 centuries ago.
I think one thing that really struck me about learning about that family, and that, you know, not only in church, but just being human together and with ancestors and stuff. On the staff last spring, we had a Norwegian woman named Olsa Friese, who was blind and when she first came, we were talking, and I was asking about her and asked her where she was from in Norwich. She said, oh, you wouldn't know that. I said, well, you know, why not shoot for it? And she said, well, the county is called Bulandet. And I said, you're kidding. That's where my grandfather came from. And she said, so we went into this whole conversation. She asked me the family name, and I told her. And she knew the island. She was from the mainland. But just her family's lived there for generations, and my grandfather's family has owned this island for generations, which bears the name, family name. And just in talking to her and hearing about the life at Bulandet, all of a sudden, you know, I thought, my word, she's real flesh and blood who lives in this place, that where I'm from, which I'm descended, we're all human together. And I got out, they're very irreligious and wild, and half of them are crazy. You know, I got found that out. See, my mother's never told me that. But, that's still, you know, just talking to her.
Yeah.
We got to be good friends, just generally, but... But just that initial conversation still, it's like a light going on in my brain every time I
Well, you talk about the whole human family, too, of course, not just those of the Christian faith, but the whole human family. I thought, supposing it were possible to defy time and bring together in the same room Moses and Isaiah and the Apostle Paul, St. Augustine, probably throw Socrates in, maybe Confucius too, and pick your crowd, Abraham Lincoln, any group of people who had integrity, highly ethical creatures, and I wonder if in a few moments they wouldn't find that they were brothers, culture notwithstanding, or anything else. And if the Lord would, give them the a common language, or do what he did at Pentecost, and let each person talk in his own language, and each person hear in his own language, like Rosenthal says, will be the case in heaven, so he can talk to Moses without learning a new language, and Moses can talk to him without learning a new language. I think there would be such a great common denominator. Because they're human and they in kind of the best sense of the word. I don't know who you'd most like to have. Don, if you could pull a few together from the past. Not Napoleon.
Probably find some brothers too.
Yeah, maybe.
Works both ways, maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know. I've been in a situation several times where I run into complete strangers out camping or in a strange city. But we feel there's something that we started talking about, and all of a sudden it's just like we knew each other.
Yeah.
It's very easy to happen. It happens a lot.
Mm-hmm. You gotta let it happen. You can't stand off. Yeah. Well, are we going back to work, Karen?
No.
We're not, huh?